This is Trend Following Radio, where great thinking comes alive. Nobel Prize winners, legendary traders, best-selling authors, and the pros that know what drive us irrational human beings. I am your host, Michael Covell. Not filtered, raw, honest. That's my passion. My guest today is the author of a new book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. She has appeared on this podcast twice before, but this is her first book, and I'm so appreciative that she has appeared yet again. Annie Duke has devoted her life to the study of decision-making under pressure. She's had a prior career as a professional poker player, won over $4 million in tournament poker. But now with this book, she's gone ahead and taken her poker expertise, her graduate level research in psychology, and she's combined it all into a unique perspective that we can all apply to our everyday lives. Without further ado, let's jump right in with Annie Duke. So Annie, I must offer the congratulations. You have had quite a few achievements in your life already, but I have a sneaky suspicion that this book stuff is going to raise the profile in a way that even you might not expect. I'm not predicting, nor do I know what that raising of profile will be, but considering the content, which covers so many areas, so many walks of life, I have a sneaky suspicion in a year's time, if we chat again, you're gonna be like, yeah, that was a real game changer.
I hope so. I mean, you know, that's why I wrote it. Not with the idea of game changer, but this is material that I've been thinking about in some form or another since the late 80s. Really, I mean, if you count my graduate school experience, but then in a really formalized form since really 2002, since I was asked to give my first talk to a group of options traders. What I really love about that is that when you're giving talks and you have to deliver it sort of spoken word and you're getting immediate feedback from the audience, you figure out a lot of stuff that you thought you knew that you didn't know because you can't actually express it coherently. That is such an amazing process to sort of hone down and figure out how to communicate these complex concepts in a way that people can really digest them. After having done that for 10 years, I really resolved that I was going to write this book. So this is really the product of that work, which I'm really excited about.
No, we've actually kind of talked about it briefly on prior episodes. Going through your acknowledgments, I was thinking, how many folks have I had on this show? Well, your brother's not been on this show, but I've interviewed your brother. Dan Ariely, Colin Cameron, Phil Tetlock, Gabrielle Ottigen. She was one of my favorites because I don't know, there was something about her content, her voice. By the end of that episode, I was like, can I come be your grad student? I just wanted to go to her class.
She's amazing. And what I love about her is that in the midst of boom and craze about positive psychology, she was this very dissenting voice with very real and robust data. And she's very passionate about that data and what it says. And she's amazing.
The data really gets at so much of the foundation of this work that you've put together. Before I jump into the work, I want to ask something. I don't think you wrote about it in the book. It's a great example, in my humble opinion. But I'm watching an entire generation right now. Let's say this is 20 to 35, roughly. I think this might be what they call the millennial generation. And as a guy who's written some trading books, I'm watching an entire generation go goo-goo gaga over cryptocurrencies, over weed stocks. And what's really interesting is that the very topics that you talk about, which are like foundational to making decisions for what they are putting their money into. What I am seeing just on a kind of cursory analysis is literally across Facebook, no comprehension. These aren't necessarily unwise or, you know, dumb people, but literally no comprehension of the types of issues that you're putting in your book, starting with the big picture of like, hey, it's a bet. And you've got to be thinking that this bet might not turn out exactly as you expect.
I have to agree. I was actually asked about what I thought about cryptocurrency recently. I'm just going to say I haven't looked at it that much. It's not something that I'm particularly interested in getting a big knowledge base about. I'm probably not going to I have no plans to invest in it. I have other things that I'm putting my knowledge base for. But the thing that I said to your point was, well, I haven't really researched it much. But if I had to give sort of the cursory opinion about it, the minute I saw McAfee start saying it's impossible for cryptocurrency to bubble, I would be very cautious for exactly the reasons that you just said, which was sort of across, you know, that my knowledge of cryptocurrency is coming from some cursory articles that I've read, and but really seeing what people are saying in the cryptocurrency community on Twitter to each other. And it seems to be a really big echo chamber of confirmation bias, a lot of bandwagoning. I just don't seem to see a whole lot of dissenting voices saying, hey, wait a minute, this is high volatility. And the other thing that I think is really interesting about it is that I see a lot of tribalism with cryptocurrency. Like, I'm a Bitcoin person, but I'm this other person. And now I'm going to, you know, because I'm into Bitcoin, I'm going to run down your cryptocurrency. And then the people in the other cryptocurrencies are running down this other cryptocurrency. So it does seem to be a lot of cognitive biases sort of coming really visibly up to the surface around that particular issues.
But you talk about, hey, you know, this is not your expertise, but I think if I kind of blur my eyes and look at the cover of your book right now, Thinking in Bets, I mean, decision-making, we could be talking about widgets. It doesn't have to be cryptocurrencies. Decision-making is decision-making, and good decision-making, and understanding uncertainty and luck and skill and all this stuff. It doesn't make a difference whether Andy Duke knows really anything about cryptocurrency. You know about the foundational precepts that we as human beings should probably be thinking about if we want to be successful in the long run.
That was kind of the point of what I just said, is that I haven't studied it deeply enough that I would feel comfortable giving someone financial advice. But what I do see is this sort of a lot of people talking about it being a sure thing. A lot of people talking about it as if it can't bubble, for example, that it couldn't go down, that, you know, this tribalism where people are attacking each other and not really understanding, look, you're investing in something that's high volatility.
We'll have to just wait a little while to see how that all shakes out. Let me jump into an example straight from your book. This is an example that I remember debating with friends a couple years ago, and I want to kind of bring it up in the beginning of the podcast and maybe a little bit at the end too. And I had my strong opinions about it. And I have to admit, reading your book, I know the things that you were talking about, but I wasn't thinking about it in the passionate moment of judging Pete Carroll's decision to throw. It's one of those things where I might have said to myself, gosh, I've watched a lot of NFL football. He should have just given it to Marshawn Lynch and let him run it and let the chips fall where they may. But there's a different way of looking at this. And I have to acknowledge that the way you lay it out is probably the way that we all should be thinking about it.
Let me just remind everybody of the decision that you're talking about. I'm sure that people in Seattle remember it and people in New England remember it. But there's 26 seconds left in the Super Bowl in 2015. And the Seahawks are on the 1 yard line. They are 4 points behind. Now, it's important to know that the Seahawks have only one timeout here. And that's just an important detail. Now, obviously, Marshawn Lynch at this time is considered to be the best running back in the NFL. In general, people were expecting that Pete Carroll was going to call a run play. Russell Wilson was going to hand the ball off to Marshawn Lynch and try to drive it across the goal line. He didn't do that. He called for Wilson to pass the ball. And as pretty much everybody will remember, the ball then got intercepted in the end zone, end of game, Patriots won. And maybe you could recall for me some of the headlines from the next day.
Pete Carroll doesn't know what he's doing, et cetera, et cetera.
I think it was a lot of worst call in Super Bowl history. There were a lot of big exclamation points. I think the word idiot was used in some, actually, I think it was effing idiot in one of the online sites. So people were really, 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 really upset about this call. They really thought that it was absolutely the worst call. I actually opened the book with this particular situation, with this particular anecdote. I go through exactly what just happened. I walk through what I just walked through with you. And then I just ask a very simple question. What do you think those headlines would have looked like if the ball were caught in that end zone?
Genius.
He's a genius. I think they probably would have said something like he outsmarted Belichick, because now the unexpectedness of the play would have been considered brilliant, right? This is the most brilliant call in Super Bowl history. Everybody was expecting the ball to be handed off to Marshawn Lynch, and Pete Carroll outsmarted Belichick and had Russell Wilson pass. It takes a very simple thought experiment to see that there's a problem here in the way that that analysis was done, which mainly had to do with people were deriving the quality of Pete Carroll's decision from the quality of the outcome that occurred. Obviously, it was a very bad quality outcome, right? They lost the game on an interception. And people were using that as a very tightly correlated signal, let's say, to what the decision quality was there. That's in poker what we call resulting. And resulting is a really wonderful word to have in your vocabulary. If you're in cognitive science, you would call it outcome bias. I love the word resulting a lot better because I feel like it's very self-explanatory. You're using the result in order to figure out whether the decision was good. I'll just walk you through really quickly the analysis that shows you that actually the call was mathematically pretty good. At the time, there were some dissenting voices. One of the people that you can go look at is Benjamin Morris on 538 if you're just curious to go see an analysis, but I'll give a summary. There's 26 seconds left. They have one timeout on the 1 yard line. If they call a run play and Marshawn Lynch doesn't get it to the end zone, they can call exactly one timeout and then hand it off to Marshawn Lynch one more time. So they get two plays. It's second down, by the way. If they pass it, here's what happens most of the time. Sometimes it's caught and sometimes it's dropped. That accounts for 99% of the occurrences. In the case that it's caught, the game is over and the Seahawks win. In the case that it's dropped, what happens? The clock stops. At which point they can hand it off to Marshawn Lynch. If he doesn't get into the end zone, they can call a timeout that they now have left and hand it off to Marshawn Lynch again. So people understand that pass was essentially a free option. About 1% of the time, it's going to get intercepted. There's some other things that can happen, like a fumble or a sack, but those can happen on the running play anyway. So about 1% of the time, that pass is going to get intercepted. In that sense, you can see that that pass is a nearly free option to get it into the end zone, preserving the option to run the two running plays also. What I say is you may agree or not agree with this analysis. And again, you can go look at Benjamin Morris's analysis to see really more deeply what the statistics look like there. But what I think is interesting is that the outcome was so bad that people didn't even give Pete Carroll the credit of having thought it through. And once you actually run through what the analysis looks like, it actually starts to look like a pretty good decision. And that's aside from, you know, you don't always want to hand it off because, you know, then you're too easy to defend against, which people might say, oh, but you shouldn't do that in the Super Bowl. Except, as I say in the book, it's really all one long game, which is a whole other thing. But I think you can see that clearly he was thinking it through. And the chorus of people just yelling that this was the most idiotic play ever were really guilty of resulting.
You know what's really tricky about it, too, is that with the Super Bowl, the last play of the Super Bowl, so much on the line. But then you can think of the thousands and thousands and thousands of play calls that Pete Carroll has made in his career. Likewise with Bill Belichick. And Pete Carroll, I mean, he's not had the same success as Bill Belichick, but he's had a lot of success. So you're right. He clearly knows something about NFL play calls. And what he knows is not every one of those calls is going to be successful. And he's comfortable with that. He knows that's part of the process.
Clearly, he got to the Super Bowl by making calls like that. That's what I think. You know, when we get on these big stages, actually, interestingly enough, on big stages like the Super Bowl, they've shown that coaches get more conservative and they actually don't go for it enough on fourth down and, you know, so on and so forth. So we've made a lot of progress kind of, you know, from the sabermetrics perspective of really getting, coaches have gotten a lot better about things like fourth down calls. But what you see is that you kind of roll back to a more old school play calling style when you get onto these very big stages in general with coaches in general. And I think it's because they're worried that the fans and the newspapers, the pundits, that they're all going to be resulting. If you happen to have one of these calls that isn't quite so obvious, not work out. So what I say is kudos to Pete Carroll for saying, I know it's the Super Bowl and I understand I'm risking that people are going to result on me and, you know, say it's the worst call in Super Bowl history or scream that I'm an idiot. but I'm willing to do what's mathematically correct here, at least as, in his opinion, which I really love. You know, I love that he was willing to do that. And I think that makes him a much greater coach for it, personally.
He was just unlucky.
He was just unlucky. And it was interesting because he went on Good Morning America and he was asked about that call. And he said something really interesting. He said, it was the worst result of a call in Super Bowl history. So clearly Pete Carroll knows something about resulting. And I love that that was his quote.
You know, there's something here too that maybe you might want to comment on. You know, for so much of modern life, we are all armchair Monday morning quarterbacks, whether that's watching, you know, poker on TV or football or whatever it might be. And there is such a difference between being in the game, spending your life to get the understanding of this whole process, making decisions, many decisions not working out, some working out, having that edge versus, you know, you just mentioned the host in Good Morning America asking, kind of going down a silly direction, really doesn't, you know, more the kind of like headline grabbing direction. Let's see if Pete Carroll will say he was an idiot, something stupid like that. But it's really interesting that we've become a very voyeuristic society where, and again, I think your new book serves a nice place on the shelf for that, to get people behind the scenes as to how the top decision makers really do it, because it's all applicable to our own lives.
Well, I completely agree with you. And the thing is that one of the problems with resulting is that you do feel really smart once you know the outcome. The decision making that we make every single day in our own lives is decisions under conditions of uncertainty, right? We don't have all the information that we need in order to make the decision. And we don't, I mean, and there's a lot of luck, right? So we have two sources of uncertainty really coming in on us, right? We can make a perfect decision and it can work out really badly. We can make a terrible decision and it can work out really well. Decisions and outcomes are really only loosely correlated. And then we have this problem of hidden information. So in poker, for example, the cards are face down and you're trying to decide what to do against your opponent when you can't see their cards. And even if you could see their cards, you could get unlucky, right? Because you can just have things not work out. So a very simple example of that that I would give from life is I can run a red light and not get a ticket and not get in an accident. But I think we can all agree that running a red light is not a good decision. And I can go through a green light following all the traffic rules, the speed limit. My car can be in perfect condition. I can make sure that I'm driving in good weather conditions. All of that, I can be as careful and as good a decision maker as I can going through a green light, and I can still get T-boned. What I think is really interesting is that it is really easy to be a Monday morning quarterback once you know the outcome. If you make this mistake of saying, well, I know the outcome, so therefore the decision must have been bad, or I know the outcome, so therefore the decision must have been good. And what I really argue in the book is that that's not a bad strategy if you're playing chess, right? So if I were to say to you, hey, you know, Michael, what's the worst decision that you made in the last year and you were a chess player? It would kind of make sense for you to go back and find some game that you just lost in spectacular fashion and then go find the errors that you made in there. Because surely if you lose a game of chess, you made some bad decisions in there. We know that. And that the reason for that is that chess, very much unlike life, is a game that doesn't have any hidden information. You can see all the pieces. And it has very little luck. It has a little bit of luck, but very little. So it's a lot easier to kind of do that derivation from the way that the game turned out. But in poker, that's a really bad thing to do. Just because I lost a hand does not mean I played it poorly. And just because I won a hand does not mean I played it well. And if I make the mistake of connecting those together too tightly, my decision making is going to be really messed up. I'm not going to learn well from the way that things are turning out. I'm not going to use my experience very well to become an expert. And I think that part of the problem is that in life, we treat it like we're playing a game of chess when we're not. We're playing a game of poker. And one of the things you can imagine for me is that you see all of these things of, oh, he's playing three-dimensional chess. Right. I mean, this is how we say, like, oh, look at what a smart decision maker is. He's playing three-dimensional chess.
It kind of does. It's meaningless.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I want to yell it to the world, like, no, if they're a really good decision maker, they're not playing three-dimensional chess, they're playing three-dimensional poker.
Take that for a second. As we talk about poker, and we've talked about poker on prior podcasts, but for those out there, they might say to themselves, oh, you know, it's just a game, da-da-da-da-da. However, and you go in this direction in your work, and I kind of love it. I didn't really know that connection myself. Game theory modeling poker. Why don't you explain that?
This is actually a fun thing I do when I give my talks. So, you know, I do keynotes, I do corporate retreats. I do deep dive consulting also, where I might go into this, but in the keynotes, I always go into this. So I always ask the audience, hey, does anybody in the audience know who John von Neumann is? And, you know, and I'll speak to pretty large audiences and I'll get like a hand or two will go up, which is fine because not a lot of people know who he is. Then I'll follow the question with, you know, okay, that's average for the audiences that I talk in front of. Does anybody know who John Nash is? And now I'll get a few more hands. And then I'll ask if anybody knows who Russell Crowe is. And then of course I get the whole audience raising their hand. And then I'll say, okay, so has anybody, you know, seen the movie A Beautiful Mind? And then you, oh, okay. And now I'll walk them back from that. So A Beautiful Mind was about John Nash, who, as your listeners might recall, Nobel laureate, in the field of game theory, famously, schizophrenic, but brilliant mathematician. And he studied at the Institute for Advanced Study, and his mentor was John von Neumann. And John von Neumann was, among other things, the father of the modern computer. He actually ran the Manhattan Project. I think because of that, actually ended up getting cancer, ended up with pancreatic cancer in the 1950s. He ran our Cold War strategy. He's the one who came up with the idea of mutually assured destruction. But while he was working on the Manhattan Project, he was moonlighting with Oscar Morgenstern, and he wrote a book called The Theory of Games, which is an incredibly influential book. And he's really considered the father, along with Morgenstern, the father of modern game theory. So the way that we think about decisions under conditions of uncertainty over time is a loose definition of what you're doing when you're studying game theory is based on von Neumann's work. And you'll notice that if I were to give you a definition of poker, that definition would align really well. In poker, I'm making decisions under conditions of uncertainty. Again, cards face down, this element of luck. And it's over time. When I make a decision against you, it's not the only decision I'll make against you. I have to make future decisions against you. So there's reputational issues. Now, the fact that those definitions happen to align pretty well is not accidental, because it turns out that John von Neumann really started thinking about this work based on a stripped down version of poker. And there's a really wonderful anecdote about von Neumann that comes from Jacob Bernofsky. He says, you know, he asked him, hey, John von Neumann, this theory of games, it's really, really interesting, but, and I'm paraphrasing here, but how come you didn't base it on the game of this theory of games, super interesting, but how come you didn't base it on the game of chess? Isn't chess like, you know, the ultimate game? And von Neumann's answer went something like this: chess, well, chess isn't even a game, it's a calculation. Poker is a game. So you can see the full quote in my book. It's just a paraphrase. But what he's getting at there is that because chess has no hidden information and very little luck, it's a game that is solvable in the same way that checkers is solvable, or the game of tic-tac-toe, which all 10-year-olds basically have solved. As long as you have enough computing power, you should be able to solve the game of chess, meaning you should be able to create a decision tree that gets you all the way out to the end of the game, so all possible moves and counter moves. And we're pretty close to that. There isn't a human being that can be a chess computer anymore. But poker is a much more difficult problem to solve, because you have hidden information and you have this luck element. So he was really basing the kind of decisions that we're studying in game theory, which is really about decision making out in the world, on the game of poker, and actually sort of poo-pooed the game of chess as a good model for decision making. So obviously, I mean, this was a really important guy. I'm a little sad that people don't remember who he was. I think it was 1950, Time magazine named him the most brilliant mathematician of the 20th century. And he just kind of got lost in the history of science, except in as much as they're pretty sure he was one of the models for Dr. Strangelove. So that seems to be That seems to be the mark he left on the popular culture world at any rate. I always say he was there at the same time as Einstein, but Einstein had the advantage of the, you know, crazy hair, the mustache, and the motorcycle, and the bicycle rather, I guess.
You know, I don't know if you know of him, but there was Thomas Schelling and Robert Allman. They both shared a Nobel Prize in game theory as well. I actually had Allman on this podcast. One of my favorite ones, I think he was like 85 years old. It was spread out over two episodes. I think he was in Israel when I talked to him. And he was so fantastically lucid and just mapping out. I still love listening to how he would just, you know, map out the thinking of it. He was talking about mutually assured destruction.
Right.
But just fantastic to listen to someone like that and then to realize that in his mind, there's math going on at a level that I probably will not have a chance to understand in my simple life, but fantastically interesting man. I agree with you. Von Neumann, Nash, Schelling, who just died a couple years ago, these guys would all be so fascinating to talk to.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and if just for fun, if people want to see an example of mutually assured destruction, I highly recommend the movie, War Games, which I don't know if you remember. It stars Matthew Broderick. Yeah, and they have the computer start playing tic-tac-toe, if you'll recall, and the computer figures out that you can't win. And then we move on to thermonuclear war to try to figure that problem out. It's a really wonderful movie that's actually about game theory in a great way. And it's kind of fun to go back and look and see what the graphics look like, you know, what the computer graphics look like in light of today. But it's one of my favorite movies, but it's a game theory movie.
I think those screens look something like Pong circa 1975, actually. They were, even though it was pretty bad stuff. Let me take you, there's so many areas that I want to touch on, and I'm not in a linear order of your book. I've got like five pages of notes in front of me. But there was something that I think would be nice. We're kind of already gone there a little bit, but I'd like the way you map it out in just a few words. You know, this all starts with a belief, then you make the bet, then you get your set of outcomes. And you've already kind of talked about that so far. And what I just said is from your book. You've got a great example, though, of this. And I still, as a kid, remember this show. I still remember this episode, laughing my rear end off, which that would have been the turkey episode in WKRP. And they had a belief that was a little wrong. And so if you don't have the belief set in the right way, you're going to have trouble with your betting. And then the outcome is going to be pretty predictable.
I think this goes back to what we sort of started this talk with about Bitcoin, right? Which is, what are your beliefs about Bitcoin? How good are you at updating your beliefs and kind of checking against what the objective truth might be? Now, obviously, it's very hard to know what the objective truth of anything is, but our goal should be to get closer and closer and closer to that. In order to do that, we have to be really good belief updaters, right? So our beliefs are really what drive the bets we make. They're what drive the decisions we make about what we think the possible future is going to look like. We have this, you know, set of beliefs that we form, and we'll get into this maybe after this anecdote, but these beliefs can be pretty bad. And if your beliefs are bad, you're going to make some pretty bad bets around them. So to come to WKRP in Cincinnati, for those who don't know the show, who aren't of my generation, it was a really funny show about a little tiny radio station, a rock, obviously. Lonnie Anderson was on it. I don't know if people remember who she was. They have a news guy, Les Nessman, and a station manager, Mr. Carlson. And because it's, of course, a rock station, they're sort of the, you know, they're the foils, right? They're sort of bumbling. Les Nessman is very uppity and Mr. Carlson is very bumbling. But Mr. Carlson decides he's got this amazing idea that he's going to do as a Thanksgiving promotion. And Les Nessman is going to be out, you know, on the scene. And this is a promotion that's going to occur over at a mall. And Les Nessman is reporting. And he's like, and he hasn't been told by Mr. Carlson what this Turkey Day promotion is going to be. So he's out at the mall and he's reporting and he's saying, okay, you know, everybody's gathering. Everybody's ready for the promotion. Oh, there's, you know, a helicopter overhead. This is really exciting. And then it just turns into mayhem and chaos as he says, wait, something's coming out of the helicopter. Wait, oh no, it's turkeys being thrown out of the helicopter. And of course, the turkeys are just raining down on the people below and smashing into cars and
not flying.
Not flying. Exactly. And they come running, you know, back into the station, and they're just bloodied and, you know, covered in feathers. And, you know, Mr. Carlson says, as God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly. And I think this is just such a wonderful example of how wrong our vets can go if our beliefs are wrong. And that, you know, that's something that we all need to remember, is that whatever we're betting on, whatever decisions we make are driven by the beliefs we have. So we would do well to always be double checking those beliefs.
So that's a great word, double checking. You know, once you have those beliefs, once you bet and you get a series of outcomes. So, okay, if your belief is I can throw turkeys out of a helicopter and I'm going to bet on that as a promotion and they, you know, they can't fly, the outcome is not going to be very good. You don't really have to go kind of back test that or reverse engineer that to really realize that the very basic belief was wrong. But you've got a great story that I love, and I want you to kind of talk about it. You talk about, I think it was your brother and Phil Ivey, and Phil, this, I think this was 2004, and Phil Ivey had won a tournament. And he won a ton of money, I think like $500,000. And he, instead of just, I don't know, celebrating or whatnot, I believe he went back and he had a private dinner conversation with your brother. And what he was trying to do, even as the winner, was reverse engineer, relook at, study, examine every play. And I'm assuming probably not only his moves, but probably everybody else at the table.
Yeah, so I think, so I want to get to that anecdote. Let me just set it up a little bit. Just to set it up, here's our basic problem, is that there's a lot of luck involved in the way that things turn out. When we think about what you just said, that beliefs inform the bets that we make, that then results in a set of possible outcomes, right? But now what we have to do is we have to take the way that the future unfolds for us, the outcome that actually occurs of the set of possible outcomes. And we have to figure out how to use that to loop that back in to update our beliefs so that we can be a better decision maker going forward. And here's the problem, is that we can't see into what the underlying cause of a particular outcome is. It could be because of bad luck, right? So if I go through a green light and I get in a car accident, I got unlucky. So in that case, that outcome is not going to inform my beliefs about whether I should drive through green lights again. Hopefully not, not if I'm doing this well, right? I'm actually going to sort that off into the luck category. I'm going to throw it into the luck bucket and say, well, okay, so that particular result I shouldn't have inform what my future decisions are going to be. Now, if I go through a red light and I get in a car accident, hopefully I'm saying, you know what, I should really be sorting that into the skill bucket, right? Into the mostly skill bucket. I should use that to update my belief about whether I should go through red lights or not. But here's the problem. If you can get in an accident going through a green light or going through a red light, how can we tell? So I think one of the examples that I give in there is just think about, you go into the doctor and you're coughing. Think about all the different reasons that you could be coughing, right? You could have a viral infection. You could have inflammation in the back of your throat that doesn't have anything to do with the virus. You could have some sort of bacterial infection. You could have cancer. You could have a neurological problem. You could have allergies. There's all sorts of reasons that you could be coughing, but all the doctor sees is the cough. And to a layman, they're all going to look relatively the same. So how do you now sort through when someone's coughing and try to go and derive what the underlying cause of the cough is? And that's actually a really hard problem. And to make it worse, you know, there's very few outcomes that are solely luck or solely skill. Normally it's some sort of combination of the two. And we're trying to sort of sort out what was it that was in our control, which would be in the skill bucket. And what was it that really wasn't in our control in the luck bucket? And that decision, which is really a second bet that we make, right? We make this initial bet that results in a set of outcomes. And then once the outcome occurs, we have to make a second bet about what part of it was in our control due to skill so that we can then become good learners about it. And what part of it was due to luck, which we would just sort of offload, right? Hopefully we wouldn't learn very much from that. So now here's the problem. Because this is very noisy, because this relationship between the outcomes that we have and the decisions we make is so loose, we have a lot of leeway when we're examining our own outcomes to take the bad stuff and just say, oh, that was bad luck. and to take the good stuff and to say, oh, that's because I'm such a genius. And that's the tendency that we have when we're sort of examining why things turned out for ourselves the way we did, right? So this is different than when we're an observer of Pete Carroll and we're just saying, oh, you had this bad outcome. You must be such a bad decision maker. That doesn't have to do with our own ego. It doesn't have to do with our own life story. Once it becomes about our own life story, we actually make this very consistent error. It's called self-serving bias. You can see why, because it serves our own self. That bad stuff is because of luck and good stuff is because of skill. And that becomes a really big problem for learning. That brings me to the story that you just brought up about Phil Ivey, who is one of the best poker players on earth. He's really, incredibly good at every single form of poker. And my brother told me a story, which I think is very illustrative of why he's so good, because he's really different than the rest of us in this way. So he won a really big tournament against an all-star final table. I mean, the other players at the table were brilliant poker players in their own right. And after he won the tournament, he went off and had dinner with my brother. Instead of saying, can you believe how great I am? Look at how well I played. Of course, I deserve to win because I outplayed everybody. I'm so great, which I'm sure is talk that we all recognize in other areas of life, right? He actually did not talk at all about how well he played. All he talked about was how poorly he had played, in the sense of he wasn't saying, look, I'm a really bad poker player. But he wanted to go through every single spot where he felt that he could have made a better decision. He was deconstructing all the hands that he thought were difficult, deconstructing all the hands that he felt maybe there was a different line of play that I could take. And he was doing that with someone who he felt was going to be giving him good feedback. Heather, of course, was one of the best poker players in the world in his own right. And that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to use it all as a learning opportunity as opposed to just basking in the glow of the win. And that really shows you a different kind of mindset where we can say it's probably not accidental that he's so good. If that's the mindset that he has, if he's so eager to try to do the sorting of luck and skill, no matter how good the outcome is for him, he's not going to feed his ego by just basking in his glory. He's going to feed his ego by making sure that he's learning as much as he can from every experience so that he has better and better and better results going forward.
And what's interesting about that too, even though, as you just mentioned, your brother, extremely accomplished, one of the best in the world, but Phil's at the top and he's still kind of like lowering down a little and saying, dissect me. Help dissect me. Let's rip me apart. Let's put it all out on the table. Let's put the blood and guts out there. I want to know what I did wrong. I want to know what I did right. Let's just get it all out there. That probably gets to some of the real important takeaways from your work, is how can we all think of our lives that way, right?
Yeah, and the conclusion that I really come to, and this is really from looking at a lot of literature and really, in particular, a lot of work from Phil Tetlock, who is University of Pennsylvania. He's at Wharton and in the Department of Psychology. Phil Tetlock and his wife, Barbara Miller, and also people like John Haidt. And there's a lot of work that really suggests that on our own, it's just really hard to do this stuff. It's really hard to try to de-bias. It's just too ingrained. And Kahneman actually talks about this, too, in Thinking Fast and Slow. Well, Kahneman is not... Obviously, Thinking Fast and Slow is not specifically trying to offer a lot of solutions to it. One of the things that he does say kind of at the as he's in this book, is saying he's starting to think that maybe better water cooler conversations might be the way to go. The idea behind this is we're also biased kind of on our own, that what we really need to do is start forming really good decision pods, right? We need really constructive decision groups, because if we're trying to derive this stuff on our own, we're just naturally always going to default to this very sort of self-serving view of the world where, in general, our beliefs are correct. We take credit for the things that happen in our lives that are good, and we offload the things that happen in our lives that don't turn out so good. You know, our beliefs are true. We're smart. You know, all of those things that we tend to really process the world in a way to support a positive self-narrative. And we process the world in the moment in a way to support that. Because one of the things that, you know, becomes obvious when you think about this is, well, okay, if I take a little bit of pain now, though, and I say, okay, I don't deserve credit for that great thing that happened, or yes, I do think that there were decisions that I made that led to this poor outcome that I could go back and change, that surely you would become a better decision maker going forward, and the quality of your results would start to shift right on the distribution, right? So you would get a lot of positive feedback going forward in the future, but you know, none of us are very good at imagining the future, and we don't want to take the pain in the moment. So left to our own devices, we're going to tend to default to that very biased interpretation of the world.
It's beliefs versus facts.
Exactly, exactly. Being in a good decision group is actually, I think, really the way to become better at this. And one thing that I think happens a lot is that people kind of think, yes, but isn't it true? Do I really need a really strong decision group? Because isn't it true that if I know about these biases, right, and I'm a smart person who knows how to analyze data, and, you know, I'm just generally like a super good at that stuff, isn't it true that I'm going to inoculate myself against the biases? If I have this great combination of being smart and also knowing about them, then won't I be really hypervigilant? And the answer is no. So it turns out that in a lot of ways, being smart makes it worse. Smart people tend to actually have stronger blind spots to their biases. That's from work from Keith Stanovich. And then the work of Dan Kahan at Yale shows us that being smart makes this kind of motivated reasoning actually much worse. The more numerate you are, the better you are with numbers and statistics and that kind of thing, the better you are actually analyzing those statistics in a way that will actually support your prior. And you can think about that just in terms of spin, right? I mean, who's really good at spinning a narrative that supports their own beliefs, right?
I want to add something to the smart. I had a buddy who played pro baseball, and he was a pretty smart guy. He had got signed out of grad school. He had been studying psychology. But after he went through the whole process, he got to the 40-man roster. He blew out his shoulder. He was a pitcher. But he lamented something to me one day, and he said, you know, I wish I was like Lenny Dykstra when it came to playing baseball. Not Lenny Dykstra after playing baseball, who was pretty much a lunatic, but Lenny Dykstra playing baseball. Because Lenny Dykstra apparently would go up and face a guy throwing 95 miles an hour, whatever, 100 miles an hour, might strike out, might get a hit, but nothing fazed the guy, apparently. He wasn't the brightest ball, but he just was kind of in the moment, not allowing himself to overthink it. And my friend was saying, gosh, you know, sometimes I think maybe some of us that know too much overthink the thing. And he was pointing out this great example of a ball player who didn't.
Yeah, I think that's a problem. And, you know, I make the point in the book that if you're sending someone into the spin room, you know, you're a politician after a debate, you're sending someone into the spin room, who are you sending in there? A super intelligent person who's really good at slicing and dicing. So, you know, I think that we need to remember that data does not exist in a vacuum, right? It needs to be interpreted by a human being. And as you know, there's all sorts of ways you can slice and dice the data. You can come at it from different frames. You know, you can pay attention to certain data points and throw out others, decide that they're not important. You have to think about how were they collected? How have they been aggregated? What kind of analyses am I going to do on it? All of that, we just don't realize how much we're doing that in a way that serves our own beliefs. I think that John Haidt said something to me that I think really resonated with me, which was, he said something to this effect. I've just realized that people are so biased that unless you have the clash of ideas out in the open square, we're all sort of doomed. I mean, it was a sort of a doom and gloom.
We don't have the clash of ideas. We have pretty much on almost every issue these days, it seems like a partisan perspective gets in front of the idea almost every time. And I feel bad for younger people today that perhaps didn't grow up. I mean, younger people that are growing up with such a hyper-partisan world where they don't get a chance to say to themselves, gosh, I don't know anything about Annie's politics. But look at the way she plays poker. I can learn from that. And I think these days we're getting people blocked out because they don't even get a chance to get to perhaps the most important thing, which is not just partisan political opinions. That's not important. That's just whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. And I think that you're getting a lot of the halo effect, right? So you have the halo effect and then sort of the reverse of that, right? So the halo effect is if you're good at one thing, I think you're good at all sorts of other things that aren't necessarily related to the thing that you're good at. And then the reverse of that would be if I don't like something about you in one domain, then I'm going to dismiss you across all domains. And when we're talking about sort of what's happening in the political world, right? If I disagree with your politics, I tend to just dismiss you altogether, you know, and sort of think your opinions have no value and you have nothing to teach me. And that's really terrifying.
Hey, let me take you in a direction for a moment. I can see in your book, and I know from prior conversations, you were very much going down the academic path. If a family member, if a brother, and if not, maybe his buddies did not bring you into the poker tables, you might have gone down a completely different path. But, of course, you, for this book, you've reached out to a lot of very, very strong, well-known academics, tremendous intellects. But how interesting is it for you, though, that you have this desire as a young person, you're going down this academic path, you get sidetracked, now you kind of come back to the academic path, but you've got this interesting experience in your holster that I don't know any other academics that probably have this in their holster, right? I mean, what a cool real life direction to detour and then flip it back and come back later in life. Fun, huh?
For a long time, I kind of felt like, oh, look, I'm circling back. Right. So for your listeners, I retired from poker in 2012 and really started doing this kind of work full time again. Here's the sort of timeline, right? So
Do you like that description? Or are you kind of pushing back a little bit?
I'm actually going to push back on that description of kind of circling back because I'm going to make the argument that I never left. And here's why. So, you know, I'm in graduate school. I'm going off to give my job talks. I actually end up with a physical illness that causes me to have to take, to delay going out onto the job market for 1 year. In academics, obviously, you know, there's a season for going out onto the job market, right? So now I have to wait a full year till the next season. And it's during that time that I start playing poker, as I'm taking that time off to get healthy. I joke that, you know, my break turned into 20 years. My brief respite turned into 20 years. In 2002, I do start doing this speaking and talking on this, but I'm fully a poker player. I view myself as a full-time poker player. In 2012, I cycle out as this more academic work starts to take much bigger place in my life. But what, you know, so if you had talked to me around 2012, I would have said, well, I've circled back around. You know, I've come back home to what I was doing in the first place. But then really, I think through through the process of this book, what I realized is actually I never left. When I was in graduate school and I was studying cognitive psychology, and specifically I was studying language acquisition, which seems like, whoa, that seems kind of far afield from poker. But what I realized is that, no, it's actually the exact same thing I'm studying. If you think about the problem for a child learning the first language, there's this very noisy system in the sense that there are these words kind of flying around. There's all sorts of objects and actions and qualities of objects that are out in the world. And the question that I was always asking myself is, how does this little tiny baby decipher some unknown word? You know, there's some word Dax, and they have to figure out that refers to the chair over in the corner, as opposed to, say, any of the other objects that might be in the room, or some quality of the chair, like soft or brown or striped, or some action that's occurring, like somebody sitting in the chair, as an example. It's very hard, right? It's a very noisy system to try to map these words onto actions, qualities, and things, and people, and sounds, and all of that stuff. And then, you know, once you've sort of done that, you've got to now take sort of the feedback that's being offered to you about whether you landed on the right idea and feedback into that back into the loop. And this is a really hard problem. Kids have this solved by the time they're about two. It's actually quite remarkable. So I was thinking about these problems of how do you learn in these very noisy systems with really, really noisy feedback. I go and start playing poker. I see this now system where this thing that I had learned in psychology, which is that learning occurs when there's lots and lots of feedback tied closely in time to decisions and actions. At a poker table, that's about the best play out of that particular sentence that you can see, right? A hand of poker takes all of about, you know, maybe 2 minutes, including the shuffle and the deal. And a hand of poker can contain up to 20 decisions. Lots and lots and lots of actions and decisions are occurring in a compressed period of time. And you're getting feedback right away, right? In this chip exchange that's occurring. I kind of realized, wow, people should really be learning very, very quickly when they're sitting at a poker table. In fact, it should be quite hard to make a living at poker, if you think about that, because there is so much feedback and so much, you know, so many decisions and actions that are occurring, and they are tied, you know, you're getting the feedback within 30 seconds. I mean, this is about as fast as you can get feedback on a decision. But what I saw was that I came in and I was able to win. As I continued in the game over the course of the 20 years that I played, I saw people really stalled in their learning, despite the fact that they were getting lots of feedback that maybe the things they were doing at the table were not necessarily optimal decisions, because most people are not Phil Ivey, right? Most people aren't winning a tournament and going and talking about every single mistake they made and how, you know, trying to deconstruct every single hand that they played. Most people are not using the feedback that's being given to them. And I realized it's really because the feedback is so noisy, right? I can have aces, the very best possible hand. You could have a seven and a two, which is the very worst possible hand, and you can still win and I can still lose. So as you're sort of sorting those outcomes out, what I noticed was that there was a very strong tendency, not just in the people that I was playing against, but certainly in myself as well, when I lost, to just say, oh, that was bad luck. And when I won, to say, oh, look at what a genius I am. That feels pretty good to sort your outcomes that way. Now, it feels pretty good in the moment, but it's pretty bad for the long run. What I realized is that these problems that I was thinking about when I was in graduate school really never went away, because I was thinking about the exact same problem. How do you learn when, you know, these things that you're trying to learn about are only loosely correlated with each other? And there's just a lot of noise in the system. Yeah. So I've really kind of changed my viewpoint on that. And I don't consider it a circle back. I consider it a never exit now. And I'm so extremely grateful for this laboratory that I landed in. I mean, I just landed in this incredible natural experiment to really start thinking about these issues of how we learn, you know, and I'm so happy for all of those experiences that have really led me to this book.
I must tell you, the word, and you know this, the word in your title that will capture the attention. I know so many trader friends that will read your book because they're going to see bets. And it's like a blinking light, you know, somebody has put bets in the title. I must read this book. There's something about that particular word. I don't know how it resonates with the masses, but I know for the folks that are self-reflecting and digging in, it's a great, great word to have in the title. I mean, really, I love the word bet. I don't, it's great.
Here's the thing is that I think that, you know, obviously, we talked about this with Bitcoin, but it's really a problem with everything is that we don't think about the fact that our decisions are bets in an explicit way. Obviously, it's always implicit that it is, because all that a bet is a decision deciding I have certain resources, could be money, time, happiness, health, whatever, right? I have certain resources, they're limited. And I have to invest these limited resources in some sort of decision that's going to drive me towards some set of possible futures. But those futures are only possible and there's a set of them, right? So there's an uncertain future that I'm driving myself toward. That's exactly what a bet is. Now, we tend to think about bets in the traditional sense, things that occur in a casino where I take my money. In that case, that would be the limited resources. And I bet on, say, a hand of blackjack. And there's some set of possible futures, right? In which I win the hand, some in which I lose the hand, some in which I double down on my bet, and then that branches off to win and lose, right? Some in which I split my cards, and that branches off into win and lose. And we're betting against somebody. In this case, it would be the house. And that's the way that we tend to think about, if I were to say to somebody, hey, what's a bet? That's what they would think. But what we need to realize is that every single decision we make is a bet, because what we're doing is we're taking whatever limited resources we have. And again, it doesn't have to be money. And we're driving toward a set of possible futures. And what we're doing is actually mostly betting against ourselves. And what that means is that there's some version of future any in that occurs when future A happens, right? And there's some future version of future Annie that occurs when future B happens, and some version of future Annie that occurs when future C happens, and so on and so forth. And so when I make a decision that's driving me toward a particular set of futures, I'm saying that the Annie that exists in that particular set of futures will be better off than the Annie that exists in the set of futures that some other decision, some other bet might have driven me toward. They're really bets against ourselves, best against different versions of future you, alternative versions of you that might occur in the future. And I think that we can all feel that really deeply under circumstances where we had some difficult decision, some difficult bet that we had to make. We were trying to decide between the two of them. And we decided on, say, option A. And we hurdled ourselves to a future that happened not to have worked out. And what do we all say to ourselves? Ugh, I knew it. I should have chosen option B. Why did I choose option A? Well, you know, I should have chosen option B. And that's really that alternative future version of us saying, I told you so.
You're bringing up something that's so critical, because so many people will perhaps at a basic level think of betting. Okay, I take a bet. Here's a potential outcome. But I think what so many people have trouble with is placing one bet and then quickly placing another and adjusting the first bet with the second bet and moving on down the chain. And that life becomes, as you're saying, thinking of bets, life becomes a bet that constantly just compounds upon itself. I think that's a tricky thing for a lot of people to think about, because it's not something that probably is brought up in the average high school or, frankly, most colleges.
Not at all. And, I actually think that this is a really sort of self-compassionate way to look at things, which is to your point, because everything is a bet. So we have bets that are compounding on each other. We have this bet that occurs where we have to bet on whether something was because of luck or skill, or what portion of it was luck or skill, so we can feed it back into the learning loop so that our beliefs can get updated better, so we can make a better bet going forward. So I think that one of the things that we really don't like to think about is that there's a lot of uncertainty out in the world, right? We don't really know what the future holds. We can't know with 100% certainty whether the bet we made is the right bet. All we're trying to do is figure out what's the highest probability that I'm going to, you know, have a good outcome here. And none of it is ever 100% or 0%. And I think that that's very scary for people. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that we're very bad at saying, I'm not sure. I think partly because, you know, when you're in school, to your point of this not being taught in school, when we're in school, and if you put I'm not sure on a test answer, you would get it wrong, right? Which is too bad, because we should be able to say, I'm not sure, but here's what I do know, and let me show you some of my work. I'm really not sure if this is right. And I think you should get extra credit for that. Because the fact is that if we were to model the world, I'm not sure is almost always the right answer to pretty much everything, right? Is this the fastest way to get to the airport? The answer would be, I'm not sure. It depends on traffic. I don't know whether there's going to be a, you know, semi that's turned over in the middle of the road. I don't know. I can tell you that in the past, given my past experiences, that this tends to be the fastest way to get to the airport, but I'm not sure today if it is. That would be a better answer for that, for example.
But I'm like, when you say I don't know and you're comfortable with it, biologically, physiologically, there's a lot of good things happening inside of us. But that when you think you have to know, and this gets into a much extended conversation, but when you think you have to know, it's creating a stress that is unsolvable. I mean, it creates really bad things inside of us. I'm giving the quick and dirty version of what happens to us biologically, but it's true. I mean, it really creates a stress to think that you can know. You can't know.
I think that a lot of the paralysis that people feel when they're making decisions is they think that they have to be certain. And it's really interesting, because one of the questions I get is, well, if I approach the world from the standpoint of uncertainty, of saying, you know, hey, I don't really know how it's going to turn out. I'm betting on it. They think, well, how do you ever make a decision then? And I said, well, that's exactly how you make a decision, because you know that you can't be certain. And so you get much better at satisficing, right? As opposed to always trying to maximize, which is really hard to do when you there's hidden information and luck, right? I think you're much more willing to say, okay, I've done my homework. I've sort of figured out what I know. I've gone to the people around me who I trust who are of the right category to give me a good opinion. I've gotten their opinion to try to check my biases, to try to check my beliefs and update those as best as I can and really kind of run the decision by them. Look, I think this is going to have the highest probability of working out. And now what's really wonderful is what you've wrapped into that is that you're uncertain. You think it's going to get you to the best place and you've done your best work to get there. And now when it doesn't work out because you recognize that there was uncertainty in the first place, it doesn't feel so bad. And we don't put up those defensive walls now as much of, well, if it didn't work out, it must have been because of bad luck. Because we recognize that wrapped in to the decision was that all we were deciding on was a set of possible futures, not one sure and certain future. And among those set of possible futures, there were futures that didn't work out so well. So we kind of thought about that in advance. We wrapped that into the decision, the bet that we made in advance. We aren't as likely to need to swat that away. It doesn't feel so bad to us because we thought about it beforehand. And when we have a good outcome, we aren't as likely to just sit there and go, well, let me bask in the glory of this because I'm so brilliant. Because the brilliance was already wrapped into the decision in the first place. And we knew that there was some possibility that that outcome was occurring.
You're not a blue pill thinker.
No, not at all. So now what you do is you can say like, look, okay, so now I had these outcomes. I knew that there was this possible set. Now let me go back and look and see, is there some way that I can improve this decision going forward? Was the good outcome more or less likely than maybe I thought it was? Was the bad outcome more or less likely than I thought it was now that I have this little bit of data here, right? Because the one data point doesn't tell us enough to make really big changes, but we can start to sort of refine based on that. Now, what's really lovely about that is not just that I think we're much less likely to be swatting these things away when they don't feel good or onboarding them when they do. We're much less likely to get emotionally distressed by a bad outcome because we've wrapped it into the decision process in the first place by thinking about it as a bad, which forces us to think about it as not certain. And that's really wonderful. But also, it allows us to be actually more decisive. And I think that that's the thing that scares people about bets the most is they think, oh, this sounds like I'm just sort of like out there. What does that mean if I'm not certain? If I'm not certain that it's going to work out, it feels more like guessing. And it's like, here's the problem, though, is that you are already guessing because you can't be 100% certain of anything. That's completely impossible. So if you know that you already are guessing, but you're walking through the world pretending like you're not, pretending like you have to be certain. Number one, you don't have an accurate view of the world, and that's bad, and that's going to degrade your decision quality. And number two, it's likely to cause you to be paralyzed because you feel like you have to get to certainty in order to actually bank a decision.
You mentioned the betting scaring people, but I might add to it, I think it's the person making the bets that scares people. So if Annie Duke is making the bet, and perhaps people that don't have your experience or your grounding, your knowledge, they observe you making the bets. And let's say we're outside the poker world. We're just in the life world. The confidence that you have, the confidence that you show, and you're not necessarily, of course, there's not time to tell everybody why you're making such and such a decision, what your process is. But I think that confidence is very scary for a lot of people that are not, they're not indoctrinated into this thinking and bets way of life.
What's really interesting that you say confidence is that the confidence for me comes from the fact that I acknowledge that I don't know. That should hopefully help people feel better about it because honestly, like if I'm in a restaurant and I'm trying to decide between two dishes or I'm at a grocery store and I'm trying to decide between which line I'm going to get into, I know that's a bet, right? I'm just betting that line A is going to be faster than line B and I might be wrong, right? I mean, not wrong in the sense of I made a poor bet, right? Because I'm sort of looking at how many things are in the person's grocery cart and how fast does it look like the checker is, but I could just end up in a line that ends up slower, even though I've gone through a good decision process. And I know that. I know that I don't know whether this line will be faster, that I'm betting that it will be. I'm actually coming from a place of saying, well, I don't really know. All I'm trying to do is use my best judgment here. And given what I do know and the presence of luck, trying to get myself to the best possible future. In that case, just being in the fastest grocery line. And the other thing that I recognize is that I never need to get anywhere near perfection in order to have this stuff worked out. We talked about this a little bit already. These things compound over time, and very small changes will make a very big difference. So if you think about it like this, you have some distribution of the quality of decisions that you make, right? And there's some decisions that are way out at the left tail. Those would be terrible, terrible decisions. Some decisions that are way out at the right tail. Those are really excellent decisions. And then you have, you know, sort of what your average looks like, right? What your average decision quality looks like. What we're really trying to do is just get more of our decisions out to the right tail, right? Maybe make the tails a little fatter. That would be good. But we're just trying to get more of our decisions to be out at the right tail. And then eventually, and I'll get to this, we're trying to shift the whole distribution. But let's just start with get more of our decisions out to the right tail. And I can do that through, for example, forming a really good decision group, right? If I form a really good decision group, then with their help, I can make sure that I'm executing more decisions that are at the right tail of my own distribution, of whatever my distribution looks like. Now, when I do that, I only have to do that a little bit. I only have to make each decision marginally better than what my decision otherwise might have been, because that creates a better probability that I'm going to have a good outcome that is then going to put me in a better position for the next decision that I have to make, which hopefully will be a little bit more to the right of my distribution, which will then create a marginally better chance that I have a good outcome, and so on and so forth. And over your lifetime, just like compounding interest, right, that's going to create a much higher likelihood of having good outcomes in your lifetime. And the example that I give in the book really comes from poker, right? We have all of this feedback happening. So let's say that you have, I'm playing in a game and I have 100 learning opportunities that got sort of dumped into my lap. And we know that it's a very noisy system, so I'm going to miss a lot of them. So let's say that if I'm sort of running on my own, left to my own devices, without doing this work of thinking in bets, let's say that maybe I catch 5 out of the 100 learning opportunities, right? So I'm missing 95% of my chances to learn. I'm catching 5 of them, okay? And now let's say that I do the hard work of thinking in bets. And what that gets me to is that I manage to now catch 10 of the learning opportunities as opposed to 5. Now notice that I'm still missing 90% of the opportunities that are being dumped in my lap to learn. But I'm going to do a lot better. Annie, who is catching 10 of those learning opportunities, is going to do a hell of a lot better than Annie, who is catching 5 of those learning opportunities. The outcomes for Annie, who catches 10, are going to be much better, because those are going to compound over time. So think about how really wonderful it is to think in bets. Because if you're not thinking in bets, if you're thinking from a standpoint of certainty, and not catching all 100 of those learning opportunities is considered failure. But by thinking in bets and understanding that we're just in this noisy system, sort of trying to do the best that we can to hurdle ourselves to the most likely good outcome that we can find, then Annie, who's only catching 10, is now a huge success because I'm doing better than I was before.
Let me go out on a limb here with you, and I think you can comment on this because I know you've done the homework, some of your research and study. But I think this quest for certainty, I would guess that for a certain number of people in the population that really get down and perhaps suffer from depression, I would suspect some of it comes from this incorrect view that they are supposed to navigate life in this certain way and that there is perfection. Whereas if someone's listening to you talk in this conversation with an open mind, they're saying, well, she seems very comfortable not knowing.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I think that if somebody looked at a particular type of therapy, like say cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, I think that some of these concepts are really wrapped into that. This idea that we shouldn't be overgeneralizing, that we can't know for certain how things are going to work out, you know, that you can't possibly achieve certainty, that when things don't work out, it's not necessarily your fault. But what has to go along with that is that sometimes it is. I mean, in the sense of sometimes there are decisions that can be improved, and sometimes the good stuff isn't because you're such a genius, and sometimes it is. So you're approaching your outcomes from a much more neutral stance. You're approaching your outcomes in a much less emotionally charged way, where what you recognize is that a single outcome really doesn't have a lot to say about what your life narrative should look like, whether that narrative of your life is positive or negative, whether you're smart, whether you're a good actor, whether you're a good decision maker. Sort of in the same sense of what Phil Ivey did, you can kind of think about it as viewing your life's outcome more from the standpoint of, as an observer, as to someone who is so incredibly emotionally invested in every single thing that happens to you. Because once you step back and you're sort of observing your outcomes in the sense of, okay, well, so this stuff happened. I recognized that I was betting in the first place. Obviously I was uncertain because by definition I am. It's an accurate representation of the world to say that there's uncertainty. And all I was doing was trying to get myself to the best possible future. So now this outcome has occurred and let me observe that and try to figure out what was luck, what was skill. Notice that the emotional charge isn't there anymore, right? We can, and there's a lot more self-compassion that comes from that because we aren't getting yanked around by the momentary fluctuations, right? It allows us to step back and I think view our lives more like a happiness stock, right? Where we're playing for the long run. And what we're really trying to do is get a positive slope. And certainly if we drill down and we take a zoom lens onto what that function looks like, as we look at that happiness stock, we're going to see these momentary fluctuations, right? As we have individual outcomes, things are going to fluctuate up and fluctuate down and fluctuate up and fluctuate down. But we know that when we're investing in a stock for the long run, where we're taking a long position, a long-term position, all we're looking for is a positive slope. And what happens at 11:30 on a Tuesday is pretty irrelevant. And if we can get to that place where we're thinking about our lives that way, where we're not being yanked around in the moment all the time, it's just going to create a lot more happiness for us. It's going to make us a lot calmer, a lot less hard on ourselves.
You know, with all your wisdom, though, that you're putting in these pages, it's up against a world that's in love with social media, which is just pushing the exact opposite of where you're pushing.
I think that you can be very smart about the way that you approach social media by approaching it as a way actually to execute on what John Haidt said, which is expose yourself to the clash of ideas in the public square. I think that it's really bad if you're on social media and you're only following people that you agree with. That's not to say that you should necessarily be following people who are at the extreme. I'm not asking you to dive yourself into the most extreme subreddit that you've ever seen. Although taking a look at that occasionally is actually quite helpful just for you to understand that those worlds exist and you should kind of understand the thinking of that. But it would be really good if everybody went and looked at their Twitter, for example, and saw if, say, they're liberal, am I only following people with liberal opinions or am I following some people with conservative opinions? If you're a conservative, are you following people with liberal opinions? And you can really do that about anything, right? I mean, obviously, as you know, there's all sorts of different theories in investing. There are people who are really pro Bitcoin or people who are anti Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, you know, and you should make sure that you have a slate. Now, obviously, you want to get the more thoughtful people from each slate. But that's the way that I use social media. I would argue that if you were to look at my social media, it would be very difficult for you to figure out whether I was a Republican or a Democrat. And that is by design and choice. Because I think it's really, really, really important for me to be seeing both sides of any argument that I want to be thinking about.
I could not agree anymore. I know sometimes in the past I've perhaps put strong views out on things, but often I'll go back and just delete something if it was too over the top. But then I will see, even in my Twitter feed, I will see certain individuals very well known, and they will put partisan positions out on both sides, different people all the time. And it just looks tiring to me.
I agree. And one of the things I like to do, so I have a newsletter that goes out every Friday, hopefully every Friday. It has so far every Friday, but you know, I'm not certain. Let me just say that. I'm not certain it will be every single Friday, but so far so good. People can subscribe to that if they want to by going over to annieduke.com. But one of the things that I'll very often do is I'll talk about a particular thing that's happened in current events, and I'll just point people to articles that are taking different positions on it. And say, go read this slate of articles. Here are these people. They're on this side of the argument. Here are these people. They're on that side of the argument. You know, just go take a look at what people are arguing on both sides. My newsletter is really taking this kind of approach that you see in the book, and applying it to current events that, you know, are happening, you know, that week or in the past few weeks before I put the newsletter out. And, you know, a lot of what I'm doing is just pointing people to opposing positions so that they can go read for themselves what a sane person on one side is saying and what a sane person on the other side of the argument is saying. Cause I think it's really important to understand, like, one of the things I say is if you have two people who are equally informed, who hold opposing but very, very extreme positions on some topic, and they're equally informed people, we know that the answer has to be somewhere in the middle. We just know that by definition, right? I mean, if you think about it mathematically, I think it's really important to be looking at that so that you can start to get a more moderated view of the world, because the extreme of something is almost never true. The only way that the extreme opinion could be true, let's say we disagree and I hold a very extreme opinion and you don't, is that I have all the information and you have zero, right? Now we can assume that it's going to be much closer to what my view is in terms of what the actual truth is, what the objective truth is. But when you have two people who are equally informed clashing in that way, we know that objectively speaking, just from a mathematical standpoint, the answer is going to lie somewhere in the middle. And the problem is that if you're only reading the person on one side, your opinion will become radicalized, because they are going to present an argument that sounds very logical. They're going to present an argument that has lots of facts. That's that spin problem. How are you slicing and dicing the data? Right. And when you're looking at that one person who's extreme on one side, who's smart and informed, slicing and dicing the data, they will be very convincing, particularly if you already agree with them. And you will then become much more extreme in your opinion. And now when you go with an open mind and you see someone on the other side of the issue, slicing and dicing that data and offering a very logical and well thought out view of the exact same topic, you naturally will become more moderated. And that's just a more accurate view of the world.
I feel so lucky to do this podcast. You know, that's my outlet. It's my way to reach out there and get all these different voices, ideas, thoughts, etc., to come into my brain. Thinking in Bets, the new book, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. I'll paint a picture for people out there to imagine where this book would fit on their shelf. If you have Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, if you have Phil Tetlock's Super Forecasting, it's in the same headspace. I think you will thoroughly enjoy it. I think it's, and of course, with Annie, you're bringing a different perspective with poker and bringing different ideas in through that avenue. So I think it's right there in that headspace. And you probably by design, I'm guessing a little bit.
I think absolutely by design. Phil Tetlock is very heavily cited in the book, as you know. Kahneman is very heavily cited. Dan Ariely with Predictably Irrational gets a shout out. Another person I just want to mention, because I think he's so important to this topic about luck and skill, is Michael Matheson.
Great.
You know, I point people in the direction of the success equation. You should have him on the show, by the way, if you haven't. I don't know if you have or not.
He has already been on twice. He actually appeared in my film years ago. He is the best. He's awesome.
He is so great. And he speaks really just so eloquently and so insightfully about this issue of luck and skill that, you know, has a pretty prominent place in my book. But I do make the point that, you know, if you want a much fuller discussion about it, you should go look at what his work is. You know, and so I'm really thinking in that same space, you know, as what John Haidt and Tetlock and Kahneman and Ariely and that kind of thing. From this perspective, I think, of having really been in this natural lab, to your point, and now looking back on my life, saying how lucky, right? How lucky that I got sick. So I had to take that year off. I had to wait till the next season of Job Talks. And it's kind of funny, because I spent a lot of time, I think, beating myself up about that one. You know, oh, should I become an academic? I don't know. Like, I feel like I sort of, you know, quit right at the end, you know, but I now consider myself so lucky to be able to take this same kind of work that fits in that same space and bring the experience of having, you know, been in this natural laboratory for how you make decisions under conditions of uncertainty for so many years and really see what the natural behaviors of humans are under those conditions. And I'm just very grateful for those experiences.
I mean, to take all the names that we just mentioned, to take this direction that you went with poker, you know, if I'm just a guy kind of looking at somebody, looking at your career, you have built a nice moat around you. It's going to be hard for someone to penetrate that moat and say, oh, I'm just like Annie. It's going to be kind of tough, you know? Maybe your brother could compete with you, you know?
Well, sadly, my brother doesn't have the academic background, so I have that moat around me too. But yes, my brother could certainly compete with me about in terms of talking about poker. And I just want to say, like, look, the people that you're talking about are my heroes, and they are giants in this space that I think in. And the fact that you would say to anybody, certainly the listeners of your podcast, that my book might be able to sit right next to theirs is incredibly kind.
Well, we know the content. I mean, I've got the book in my hands, and you guys were kind enough to ship me two to Asia. I got it from multiple sources. But look, the content, you and I know the content, and it is in that same headspace, and you do bring this unique take with the poker perspective. And it's by no means are you putting poker on every page either. It's actually quite different than probably our prior conversations where we did talk more poker. The book is very varied and wide.
Yeah, it's just so people aren't scared of the book. It's very poker light, actually. There's a few fun stories from the poker world that I think that people will enjoy, including one which involves somebody moving to Des Moines on a bet, which I think is hilarious. But mostly it's just setting up this idea that poker informs decision making in a way that, say, chess doesn't, because you have this hidden information problem. And so it can inform decision making in life in a different way. You don't need to have ever played a hand of poker in order to really get something out of the book. I just want to make that really clear. I really appreciate your enthusiasm for the book, and I'm hoping that other people will find the same enthusiasm for it that you have. It makes me feel really good, and I appreciate it.
AnnieDuke.com, right? The book is going to be on Amazon, all those fun places, easily found. Annie, you will probably do number two. I tell this to people when they come on the show and they talk about their first book. And I think sometimes people say, no, but I'm just telling you, I'm just sneaky suspicion.
Well, I'll tell you. So the book is out February 6th. I'm really excited about, and I will tell you that I am actually working on a meeting with my agent, who I just want to give a shout out to my agent, Jim Levine, who is absolutely the loveliest person in the world and has been incredible to work with. I mean, I have had such a good experience writing this book, both with my agent and my publisher. And, you know, I've heard people not have such good experiences in those spaces. So I just want to give a shout out that it has been a dream to work with everybody involved in this book. I'm so grateful to them. And I am going to talk to him about my next endeavor, because I've already started to think about what the next book might look like, mainly because I feel like in writing this book, there was just naturally a lot of stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor, or things that I handled in a light way that I feel like could have really been blown out into something big. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm not there yet, but I am already exploring. So I predict that your prediction is at least partially true.
You know, I tell you what, the blowing it out idea, my first book came out in 2004. It was around 80,000 words. The next edition got it up to like 100,000 words. I did a fifth edition of that book in 2017. It got up to 220,000 words, basically a textbook. They might not feel natural to go that heavy, but with the topics that you're in the middle of, I guarantee the audience would jump there.
Well, you know, we'll see. I hope so. I mean, I would handle it not as blowing up this particular book, but creating another book that's a companion. I tell people that I love what I do, and I love the stuff that I think about. And I have some sort of conversations about it every single day, because it's really what lights me up inside intellectually. I want to keep getting lit up inside. What this book has done for me is allowed me to explore it in a way that's more deep and immersive than the other kinds of things that I do, which are the keynoting and the corporate retreats and the consulting, where I'm coming in, I'm doing it, and then, you know, I'm going back home. And certainly I'm thinking about it at other times, but a book forces you into such an immersive and deep dive experience. If it's what energizes you, if thinking in the space energizes you, what an amazing experience to have. And I want more of it. I want more of that.
Congratulations. Hopefully we will talk again when the next one comes. Again, the book, Thinking in Bats, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. And guess what? You don't have all the facts. Annie Duke.
Thank you so much.
I see a time when those awake will understand how to make money in up, down, and surprise markets. Whether new trader or experienced, college student or financial advisor, protecting against a crash or just trying to make a lot of money, Trend Following offers everyone an answer in uncertain times. To get started immediately, send me an email, michael@covell.com. I will send you the right trend following steps to take along with my free video. But if you want to buy and hold, trust the government and trust Wall Street. This is absolutely not for you.